sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Like 9/11, the Oklahoma City bombing, the 7/7 bombings in London, the Boston Marathon bombing, investigation and trial are full of anomalies, inconsistencies, lies, murders, and evidence of a cover-up. Today you'll hear journalist and author Russ Baker, founder and editor-in-chief of the blog whowhatwhy.org, and author of the book Family of Secrets, and journalist James Henry discussing the Boston Marathon bombing trial of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. This is from the Who, What, Why weekly podcast, recorded in late April. It starts with Russ Baker discussing why he began to investigate the Boston Marathon bombing. And here he is, Russ Baker.
You know, I was in New York on 9/11, and I raced down to the World Trade Center and was actually there when the buildings collapsed. I covered it for the Los Angeles Times and for British publications. And I saw in that case, and I saw in many, many of the stories that I've covered that involve the security state, a failure to, shall we say, fully investigate and fully answer our questions about the larger picture of what happened. And what I mean is that in every instance we are told in this country that lone wolves or people involved with small foreign cells are always involved with these things, and yet the net effect is that we lose our freedom, that there are always new measures taken, and we see a consistent growth of the extremely lucrative Homeland Security entity, which is an adjunct to the already extremely lucrative defense establishment or military industrial complex, as Eisenhower referred to it. So I look with skepticism and wariness whenever I see us being told that we need to be more afraid and that we need to give up more of our freedom and give up more of our dollars to those who would supposedly protect us. And so that's just kind of my default reaction. Now, in the case of the Boston Marathon bombing, what struck me right away was the rush to judgment. It was the same thing we saw with the Kennedy assassination, with Lee Harvey Oswald. Instead of what you would expect, which would be a major investigation that would unfold over the course of months or even years with a very complicated situation, we saw a rush, and that within days we were told that everything had been answered, that there was no more to the story, and that we ought to really not even look. And we also saw a tremendous orchestration of kind of groupthink, I would call it, and a sort of a hagiography built around various supposedly heroic figures and so forth. And these things trouble me because I'm well aware of the extensive, what you might call, psyops operations that are traditionally in play. And in fact, those things are even taught at our military academies. There are courses where people are taught about these types of things. So I go into all of these situations a little bit skeptical and wanting to know more.
Here he's explaining the relationship between the Tsarnaev brothers and the federal government.
The basic facts of this are that the U.S. government was forced to admit a prior relationship with the elder brother, one of the two men accused of this bombing. They hid that relationship. That was revealed by Russian intelligence. The U.S. government was embarrassed and forced to admit that, yes, they were aware of the elder brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and that, in fact, they had directly interacted with him. They had been inside his home on multiple occasions. And his family said that they believed that the son may have had some sort of relationship with the FBI. Now, the other piece of background here is that the FBI, which is the principal actor in this whole thing, has a long history of essentially fomenting illegal activity and then catching the perpetrators. And anybody who's followed the FBI's history knows this. This is well documented. Even a cautious outfit like the New York Times pointed out that 18 of 22 so-called terrorist acts in the United States or plans involved an FBI infiltrator or inciter. And so when you know that as the background, I think that's the background which I think needs to be clear that other people on our team bring to this, is a wariness and a knowledge of what came before. And so knowing all of that and then seeing the government saying, well, we did interact with this man, but we didn't know he was planning to do this, okay, that's possible. But when you actually study what the government did to investigate the claims from the very competent Russian FSB that this man was up to something, it was ludicrous. The FBI, instead of secretly monitoring this man, came in like a bull in the china shop, actually went in and literally said to him, are you a terrorist? And he said no, supposedly. And they went to his neighbors and said, hey, is this guy a terrorist? Now, I don't know about you, but that seems to me not very high-level tradecraft. And it seems to me like either unbelievable malpractice and incompetence or a deliberate effort not to investigate.
Here, Russ Baker is asked to comment on why the government, if they made a mistake or were incompetent, would go ahead with the trial. Why wouldn't they accept a plea bargain?
The stakes were very, very high. The American public has been softened up so much over the years and has been made to respond and almost have trouble differentiating between what has been constructed and what is real. And so I think that there was a sense that all this had to be carried out on this grand stage, and it all needed to be carried out in a particular way. And I would also say that with the role of who, what, why in particular, in raising questions and poking holes and finding all of these anomalies, inconsistencies, outright lies, the harassment of important or silencing of important witnesses, that the stakes grew and it became even more important that the Department of Justice basically, quote unquote, proved to the public that everything was just the way that they said it was.
And now here's James Henry addressing why the government would take the risk when things might not go as planned.
And I've thought about this a lot, and it's not entirely clear, but it does seem that, like Russ is saying, I think they're just fairly confident, almost supremely confident, that they're going to get away with this kind of stuff because the public does not question it. Everybody falls in line. There's sort of a Pavlovian response the minute they say, you know, Islamic terrorists. Everybody just says, oh, that's it. They must be guilty. There's nothing more to see here. So this sort of narrative will help strengthen. They have a lot to gain by this.
Now Russ is asked to comment on the New York Times article that pointed out that in the trial of Jokhar Tsarnaev, the defense was pretty much focused on the penalty aspect.
Yeah, that is the only thing that the assembled might of the American media has done. And by the way, the New York Times is weeks late to say that because every other news organization has already reported that because it's just a fact. So I don't even know why that's an interesting story, but nevertheless, there it is, that the defense decided a long time ago that there was no way that they could win this thing. I think they did a bit of investigating early on, and the reality is that he is represented by a federal defender, and she assembled a team, including some outside folks, but one of the key people on the team, very importantly, is a woman who, in high-profile cases, including the Unabomber, was able to get the defendant off of the death penalty to life in prison. And so I don't know how they were expecting or to be expected to do anything else. We didn't see that. And they did not pursue any of these other angles that we've been raising. And I think they probably said, you know, the same thing that James said, that the might of the security state is just too great. And also the fact that she's a federal defender. She's not a fully independent criminal defense lawyer. The resources presumably were not unlimited, and they've been shutting down inquiries everywhere. James Henry, in particular of our team, has been attempting under the Freedom of Information Act to obtain documents, and at every turn we are told you can't have them, that this is an ongoing investigation and you can't see them. So it is locked down very, very tightly, and I think the defense just said, this is too big for us. There's no way we can pull this off. And I have to say that the enormity of what we would be talking about, in other words, the fundamental corruption of the state itself, is something that, how do you talk about that and retain your reputation, your credibility, and so on? It's very, very treacherous terrain.
Now Russ is asked to talk about the mysterious Danny.
Danny is the nickname assigned to a man who until recently was unnamed. We were told that the same week of the bombing, several days later, that the FBI put up some video of two young men wearing backpacks at the marathon and said, these are subjects of interest. If anybody knows who they are, please tell us. That was on Thursday. That was 3 days after the bombings. Shortly after that, we were told that a police officer at MIT was shot, and then shortly after that, that there was a carjacking, and subsequent to that, the unnamed carjacking, the alleged unnamed carjacking victim purportedly escaped from the car and then said, I was carjacked by these two brothers, and he claimed that they confessed to him, that they stated that they were the perpetrators of the Boston Marathon bombing and the murder of this MIT officer. I was struck by that because I thought that is just incredibly neat. I also wondered whether it would be normal behavior when you already have a gun and you're trying to get out of town or save your life. The gun ought to be enough to get somebody to do what you want, and I don't know why you would confess to him or announce it necessarily. Also, in the course of a 6 month or so investigation that we did at Who, What, Why, we found tremendous inconsistencies in this Danny's narrative. We found that he had changed his story. Now, none of that has been brought up at trial. And it's deeply disturbing that the defense itself does not bring up this documented inconsistency in what this man has said. And why this is so important is because his original account did not portray the brothers as murderous at all. It portrayed them as people who assured him that he would not be hurt and, in fact, left him alone in the car, that they were away from the car, and that he simply opened the door and ran away, which, again, doesn't paint the portrait of very sophisticated, ruthless, murderous individuals. It could perhaps portray people who are carjackers, perhaps. Although, even in one of his accounts, he indicated that he was not carjacked at all, that they simply took his car. And so those kinds of tremendous inconsistencies obviously should be fodder for the defense to at least raise, but they've decided, they've thrown the towel and they decided not to raise any of that. And so this Danny, now identified as Dun Meng, a Chinese national, came to this country as a graduate student whose own immigration status, like many of the figures surrounding this story, was uncertain. Tamerlan Tsarnaev was hoping to obtain a passport. This young man, this Chinese young man, we are told, has a startup and is interested in attaining citizenship here. Those are the exact kind of situations that the FBI has historically taken advantage of, offering people an opportunity to get what they're after in return for some kind of cooperation.
Here he's asked what he thought of the video of Danny running from the car.
You know, I look at that and all I see is this guy open the door and run away. And he runs across the street and he tells this man at this other gas station, help, I need to hide and call the police. But you don't see, unless I missed it, you don't see the murderous Tamerlan Tsarnaev or the murderous Johar Tsarnaev in the picture at all. And you certainly don't see them chasing him. The final narrative that we were told, that the prosecution told in their opening statement, was that Danny was sitting in the car and Tamerlan Tsarnaev was sitting next to him with a gun. And they said that he got distracted for a second fiddling with the GPS and then this fellow escaped. But I mean, if this guy was so fearsome as he is purported to have been in this Watertown shootout, lobbing bombs and everything. I cannot imagine how he would just meekly allow the man sitting next to him to open the door, run away, and wouldn't chase him, wouldn't get out of the car, wouldn't fire, wouldn't do something. Because obviously, once this guy escapes, the whole thing is over. I mean, how would you just be kind of blasé about that? You know, the indication we have is that the elder brother goes into the convenience store at the gas station and says to the younger brother, we got to get out of here, and they leave, and that's it. But I don't see any of that in the video. I mean, you certainly don't see them pursuing this fellow.
Next, he comments on all of the video used in the trial, including the video shown at the finish line of the Boston Marathon.
The video generally is quite inconclusive, and so what the prosecution does is they say that they have people describing for the jury what the video purportedly shows, but it's not clear at all that the video shows that. But you see, the key issue here is when you have a prosecution and a defense that are going in agreeing that these people did it, there is no will for a closer look at this. The defense is hardly objecting, as I understand it, at all to any of these things or pointing out that these don't show that because they're in that untenable position. Their opening statement was, he's the one, he did it. It was him, and that's where they are. And so, again, all they're trying to do is to try to convince the jury not to give this man the death penalty. They in no way want to antagonize them or this kind of groupthink and this unified media drumbeat that they did it. And the concern here is that we may never learn what really happened. And, you know, the public, because of its lack of discernment, lack of sophistication, and really being made to grow more and more passive, some would say even sheep-like, react very much on a kind of a chemical level, just as you get worked up over, you know, sporting things and wars and so on, where they become angry when you even raise questions. They become hostile, and I can tell you from personal experience, I've had cab drivers and other people, and I'm afraid to just even say, hey, there may be some questions because they don't want to hear about it. So getting back to these videos, a million questions about the videos, a million questions about all of these things, and I think the key point is there's a high probability that both of these brothers were involved with something, but they may have been unwitting of a larger operation. They may have been part of, we know there were drills going on, security drills around major events like the marathon. There were people who were parts of these drills. We don't know if they were simply told to go with their backpacks and pretend to do something. We simply don't know. And the older brother is dead. The younger brother, I mean, frankly, they tried to kill him. You know, he was hiding in a boat. He never fired a single shot. He didn't do anything. And they shot it like they were Pretty Boy Floyd. You know, they just shot up the boat without any provocation, and this guy sustained very serious injuries, and now, as Laura said, he was in jail under these special administrative measures where he was prevented from talking to people like us or anybody for that matter, and his family was told by the defense, keep your mouths shut, because the only hope that this guy does not fry is if he goes along with the plan. And so the point is, there's nobody out there advocating for the truth in the trial setting.
And now here's James Henry talking about the harassment of the Sarnoff brothers' friends and the death of one of them.
There's been just what looks like a concerted effort to intimidate any and all people surrounding these brothers. And they, of course, happen to be immigrant status, shaky immigrant status for some of them, you know, expired green cards or green cards that are up for renewal. And again, this happened to be the most vulnerable populations when it comes to intimidation. The federal law enforcement, that is the FBI, they have obviously a close connection with federal immigration authorities, and they work hand in glove, move on people to get them to do what they want. So there's been, I would say, a dozen I could think of people who have either been deported or put in jail under sort of questionable situations, whether they're awaiting deportation or whether they're brought up on criminal charges. It has the effect of just silencing anybody who might know a little bit more about this backstory that we've been referring to, which is what kind of a relationship did these brothers have with federal authorities? And my guess is that they just don't want the truth of this sort of thing coming out. So what better way to get everybody to shut their mouth than to just make an example out of a few of them, and then everybody else is going to play ball? I mean, there's one that comes to mind is a gentleman early on. He was questioned by the FBI. They wanted him to become an informant on other people that may or may not know anything about the Sarnez. And apparently he refused, so now he's in jail. There's the taxi cab driver, Madanoff, who understandably tried to distance himself from these two brothers, even though he was the one that reached out to police and said, yes, I knew them, they called me, I had dinner with them. But prior to that, apparently he erased a few things off of his computer, probably scared to death knowing that he's an immigrant. And so now he's in jail. He apparently was suffering some sort of abuse while in jail from guards and or inmates. So again, another person who's made the mistake of being friends with these two, and they find themselves in hot water. So there's just a deep, ongoing, sustained pattern of what looks like intimidation of anybody they knew, and I can't think of a better way to keep the lid on the backstory than that, really.
Here, Russ Baker is asked to comment on what may have actually happened at the Boston Marathon bombing.
Well, you know, we don't know, and one wants to be careful about speculating too much, but as an investigative reporter, I can tell you that that's what we do. You do try to imagine what might have happened, and I'll just throw something out. I don't know that this happened, but I could imagine that if the FBI was operating as they usually do, by the way, another instance is the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the first attempt to take the World Trade Center down, involved an FBI operative by the name of Emad Salem. He was a retired Egyptian military officer who was asked by the FBI to go into the mosques and try to sort of suss out people who might be inclined to commit acts. And he was involved in encouraging them to commit these acts. And in fact, he became disgusted at his own role, and he wore a wire where he taped he himself talking to the FBI handler and saying, look, you know, we made this thing happen. He says that. And so when you look at this, following that pattern of logic and the way, as James Henry pointed out, that they work with people who want green cards and so forth, I could imagine that Tamerlan Tsarnaev would have become, it would be normal practice, that at least when they were alerted to him, if not earlier, that he would have been somebody that they would have wanted to work with to tease out purported terror cells, to encourage people to go close to, if not cross, that line. Now, what happened next, we don't know. Was he, the older brother, recruited to make something happen, and were they planning to then arrest him and the other people around him and chalk up yet another phony success? And did something go horribly wrong? We don't know. Did some very cynical person say, you know what, let the carnage happen because the result is that we have more power and more budget? That's a horrific thing to say until you know about Operation Northwoods, where under John F. Kennedy, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you can look this up on Wikipedia, Operation Northwoods, the Joint Chiefs of Staff proposed to John F. Kennedy that the United States attack itself, that there might well be fatalities and casualties, but that they attack itself and blame it on Cuba as an excuse to invade Cuba. Kennedy was disgusted and horrified by this, but obviously, if they could do things like that back then, what would be stopping certain people with certain questionable value systems or priorities from saying it's okay sometimes to let these things happen? I mean, if we go back and we look at Cheney's crowd with the Project for the New American Century, they actually stated in a position paper just prior to George Bush becoming president that they felt it was important for the United States to have a justification to project military strength throughout the world to protect interests, which were supposed to be oil and other such things. And they said that they felt that, however, the American public would not tolerate this short of another Pearl Harbor. And so there are people who feel that it's necessary sometimes to allow horrific things to happen to justify what they perceive to be necessary responses that advance particular interests. And if we get to the bottom line, we're talking about not just power, but we're talking about a lot of money being on the line. And it's horrible, and people shrink from this, and they don't want to hear about it. But, hey, those are the facts, folks. It's my sense in these kinds of stories that if you can get a good thread and pull it, the whole carefully constructed narrative may well unravel. I would say that would have been true of BCCI, Iran-Contra, many of these other stories. And I think that's why there's such a concerted effort to block these at every turn. So my sense is that if the media, and I basically fault the media for this, if a large media organization were ever to do its job, any of the networks, the New York Times, anybody like that were ever to actually do their job, to just take something like Danny and promote, you know, look, we're a small nonprofit outfit. Obviously, these large commercial organizations, if they took, let's say, the Danny story or questions about Officer Collier's death, why they would have shot him, why they would have been on an empty campus at that point when they were supposedly fleeing for their lives, why his car was parked between buildings. I mean, he seemingly was told to be there for some reason, but we don't know why. Any of these things, many of which we've raised on Who, What, Why, I think that properly investigated, the whole picture could change.
Again, you were just listening to parts of a podcast with Russ Baker and James Henry from the website whowhatwhy.com. Russ Baker is the author of the highly recommended book Family of Secrets about the Bush family and the founder and editor-in-chief of the website whowhatwhy.com. James Henry is a contributing journalist to Who, What, Why and has joined me on the show before about the Boston Marathon bombing. 21-year-old Jokhar Tsarnaev, since this podcast took place, has been given the death sentence for his alleged role in the Boston Marathon bombing. There will likely now be a lengthy appeals process. What I took away from listening to this podcast today is that we live in a country where the FBI sets up, quote, domestic terrorists, killing and injuring some of us in the process, then miraculously catches the alleged criminals that they set up, denies them justice in the courts, harasses, imprisons, deports, or kills their friends or anyone who had any information about what might have happened. And the corporate media rarely challenges them and most of the time perpetuates their lies. So these three institutions, the FBI, the courts, and the media, no longer protect, provide justice, or investigate and report what's really going on. It's really a very sad state of affairs. And now I want to remind you that 9/11 wake-up calls shows are archived on the station website, wwuh.org, for 2 weeks after airing. And they're permanently archived on the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And once on the website there, in the search box, just type in Cheryl with a C and all the shows should pop up. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.